and welcome again to the Old Time Radio Hour. In this season of political conventions, we bring you a hilarious tribute to the American tradition of satire by Stan Freberg. He opens with a satire of a political convention that is very fresh and timely in 2016, although it was created 60 years ago in 1956. You will love this show as we all watch the convention attendees act so silly on television. Not much has changed. After that, we present part one of a five-part history of NBC Radio Network, narrated by Ben Grauer. Enjoy Stan Freberg's show, the CBS Radio Workshop, first broadcast August 31st, 1956, on CBS.
From Hollywood, the CBS Radio Workshop.
Well, from where we sit in this air-conditioned, glassed-in control room high above the floor on the convention coliseum, it would appear that Eustace J. Favorite Son has the nomination all but sewed up. He is only 10 votes short of the needed 667, and New Mexico's 16 votes can put him over the top. The roll call is about to continue, so now back to Sam Pierce on the convention floor.
There's Sam Pierce once again. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, the final moments of the 64 convention are really something. Well, Larry Thor is here on the floor with me. Larry, do you have a comment?
Yes, I do, Sam Pierce. It seems to me that the final moments of this 1964 convention are really something.
That's how I would have put it, Larry Thor. Chairman Cal Porter is pounding the gavel for silence now. And it's my guess New Mexico will throw her entire 16 votes for Eustace J. Favorite Son. Right, Larry Thor?
Right, Sam Pierce.
The convention will please be in order. Whereas in previous years, many delegates complained that they did not get to wave a sign in front of the cameras and thereby missed the opportunity of obscuring the television audience's view, this year, all delegates without signs to hold have been given balloons on long strings. This way, everybody gets to hold something. But this morning, two states got into a fight over civil rights, and Alabama broke an Oregon balloon with a lighted cigar. Now, balloon breaking is the kind of thing that can split our party. So let's have respect for the other fellow's balloons, at least in front of the television cameras. Now, New Mexico.
New Mexico, 16 votes.
Mr. Chairman, New Mexico, home of the pinto bean and the land of 10,000 lakes, proudly casts its 16 votes. In a moment, the result of those votes. But first, Mother and Dad, thinking of sending the kids to camp this year? Don't you do it. Bring the whole family to fabulous, colorful New Mexico. Home of the pinto bean and land of 10,000 lakes. Say, you can bet your bottom dollar...
Mr. Chairman, I rise to a point of order.
May I remind the chair that under the unit rule, I have a full minute for my state commercial.
That is true, but your slogan is home of the pinto bean and land of enchantment, not land of 10,000 lakes.
Mr. Chairman.
The chair recognizes Minnesota.
Land of 10,000 lakes is Minnesota's slogan.
I know, but I like it.
All right, New Mexico, that will do.
No, if I can't have land of 10,000 lakes, I don't want home of the pinto bean.
Oh, well, then take home of the jumping frog. That hasn't been used.
Mr. Chairman!
Chair recognizes California.
Before the chair gives away jumping frogs, I would like to call attention to the fact that the original jumping frog, which Mark Twain immortalized, was an amphibian from Calaveras County, which is in California!
Yeah! Order! Order! Order!
Mr. Chairman?
Order!
Mr. Chairman?
The chair recognizes the delegate from Missouri.
May I remind the delegate from California that the birthplace of Mark Twain was the little town of Hannibal on the banks of the Mississippi, in the great and glorious state of Missouri.
Order! 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 All right, Missouri, sit down! New Mexico won't use your old frog.
I will if I want to. I got to where I like it now. New Mexico, home of the pinto bean and a jumping frog!
New Mexico? New Mexico, you can just hand me your balloon.
Sam Pierce again. The delegate from New Mexico is visibly shaken by the chairman's rebuke. He is relinquishing his balloon now. Well, this is a tense moment, ladies and gentlemen. Anything can happen now. Anything.
Mr. Chairman, are we here to squabble over slogans I'll nominate a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America!
First things first. Now, New Mexico. How about home of the Western Meadowlark? That has a nice sound.
Mr. Chairman, the Western Meadowlark is the state bird of Montana.
Well, you could share your bird with New Mexico. That's the American way.
I won't do it.
All right, then. Here, New Mexico, here's a dandy. New Mexico, overflowing with the milk of human kindness.
Point of order, point of order. Mr. Chairman, Wisconsin is America's dairyland.
Oh, sit down, Wisconsin. Sit down. Sit down. Now this convention will come to order, or I will take away all of your musketeer hats.
Oh! Hey, what'd you turn the set off for? That was Stan Freeberg kidding the political convention.
I don't care. He makes me mad. He doesn't take anything serious.
Yes, he does. That's satire.
Satire? What's satire?
In the next half hour, we will attempt to answer that question as CBS Radio presents the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, Colloquy 3, an analysis of satire. What is satire? How does it differ from wit, from humor, from criticism? Is it all of these or none of these? To help us answer this question, the CBS Radio Workshop is proud to present one of the most penetrating young satirists of our time, the Capitol Recording star, Stan Freeberg.
Thank you very much and good evening. Well, what is satire? That's a good question. Well, there are all kinds of satire. We opened the show tonight with a political satire, for example.
Yes,
and
it was an outrage to right-thinking Americans everywhere.
Well, just a minute. You can't come bursting in here.
Oh, yes, I can. I am the censor.
Oh, you mean the network censor?
Oh, no. Censor with a capital C. I represent society.
With a capital S?
No, lowercase. I represent public opinion. There are some things too serious to be kidded, too sacred. Big business, labor, the farmer, the American way, mom, politics.
What's the matter with kidding politics?
You can't afford to offend one party or the other.
Oh, but that little exercise in rodomontade was not directed at any political party. I was only poking fun at the absurdity of all conventions.
Well, maybe. But you offended the states. The idea, having the delegates carry balloons.
Tell me something. Did you watch the conventions recently?
Of course, and very carefully, I can tell you.
Well, then, honestly, didn't they look a little like big rowdy kids? Sort of a ding-dong school with delegates?
That's a slanderous statement. I might even say a dangerous thought.
Oh, come on. All I suggested was this could be a convention of 1964 if they keep on at the rate they're going.
What do you hope to gain by such impertinence?
Gee, frankly, I don't know, but I can't help myself. A lot of things and a lot of people strike me as being funny, that's all. And by holding up a satirical mirror to them, maybe in a small way I can help them to laugh at themselves. And then everybody might be a little wiser. And even maybe a little happier.
Yes, but you went too far when you put mouseketeer's hats on the delegates. Now that's defamation.
No, it's not. It's all in fun. Where's your sense of humor? Besides, our political conventions are nothing more than glorified Mickey Mouse cartoons anyway.
Watch your tongue, watch your tongue.
That's not my tongue, that's Will Rogers' tongue.
Tch, I don't believe it. Will Rogers was a great American. He wouldn't have said anything like that.
Well, gee, I'm sorry to argue with you, sir, but in September 1932 he did say it. Listen, this is what Will said.
Well, our national political conventions, if you have ever attended one, or heard it over the radio, are nothing more than glorified Mickey Mouse cartoons and are solely for amusement purposes.
Unquote.
Why, I just can't believe that 100% American like Will Rogers could have
gotten away with it.
Shocking. Simply shocking. Why, it verges on the seditious.
Well, look, if you don't mind, I'd like to get this show on the road.
All right, go right ahead. Please. But I warn you, I'll be making notes of everything you say.
Fine, be my guest.
May I borrow your pen?
Oh, certainly, here you are.
Oh, I hate ballpoints.
Aren't you afraid you'll offend the ballpoint people?
Don't you get smart with me, young man.
All right, sorry. Now, where was I? Oh, yes, what is satire? Well, it's a lot more than pointless fun-poking. Satire is criticism, first, last, and always. But criticism disguising itself in the bright robes of barbed wit. The jester may insult the king, so long as he does it with a laugh. So criticism, arm in arm with humor, glides confidently past the censor.
Well, you're not gliding past me, young man.
I know. Satire is as old as man's pomposity. More than 2,000 years ago, Juvenal pierced the stuffed togas of ancient Rome with the same weapon Alexander Pope used to clip the powdered periwigs of 17th century London, or Ogden Nash to puncture the tinsel bubbles of Park Avenue's pretensions. But long before these viewers were alarmed, there was a playwright named Aristophanes, a Greek. He didn't think much of the works of another playwright named Aeschylus. In fact, he seems to have come to the conclusion that Aeschylus was one Greek who didn't have a word for it. At least Aristophanes wasn't bearing any gifts when in his great satire, The Frogs, he had this to say of Aeschylus.
I know him. I've seen him years ago, wooden-mouthed. No door, no bolt, no bridle to his tongue. A torrent of wild bombast. Intelligible? Not one line.
24 centuries later, a contemporary satirist felt the same way about rock and roll.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream.
All right, hold it, you guys. This is a rhythm and blues number. You gotta be careful or somebody liable to understand what you're singing about. You want that to happen?
No.
Well, then you gotta talk unintelligible like me, right, Stella?
You said it!
Okay. Now, you guys want to sell a few records?
Yeah.
Well, then stick some old rags in your mouth and take it again from the top, okay?
Okay.
I don't understand the words now. Real mumbly, huh? Life could be a dream. Shaboom, if I could take you up with a dying bubble. Shaboom, it will be done. I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream. Sweetheart, I will again. Shaboom, I'll
intelligible? Not one line. But satire's weapon is the same, exaggeration. There was another top tune a while back that came marching out of my radio so often I began to think my set had been made in Texas by Texans. Remember? Got so the only place you could escape it was diving for abalone in the Straits of Juan de Fuca. So fearful of being snare drummed to death, I rushed to the studio and recorded this.
That I am gonna say, nobody else could miss her, not half as much as me. She cried so when I left her, pardon me. That's just a shade loud on the snare drum.
She's sweetest little rosebud at Texas Avenue. Her eyes are bright as diamonds, they sparkle like the dew.
See, now you covered up sparkle like the dew. One of the loveliest parts in the whole Texas.
Hey, what's the idea of turning it off?
I warned you, and you've gone too far.
Oh, please.
That is a direct insult to the Lone Star State, to say nothing of Southern womanhood and the memory of the boys in gray.
You think maybe I should have cleared it first with the state capitol at Austin, huh?
They would never have given you permission.
See what I mean? You see what we're coming to? It won't be long before you'll have to carry a license to laugh.
Exaggeration again?
You think so, huh? Listen, before I was allowed to laugh at Jack Webb, I had to get his written permission. And the only reason I ever got it is that Jack's shirt is not stuffed. He thought this was funny.
The legend you are about to hear is true. Only the needle should be changed to protect the record.
This is the countryside. My name is St. George. I'm a knight. Saturday, July 10th, 8:05 p.m. I was working out of the castle on the night watch when a call came in from the chief. A dragon had been devouring maidens. Homicide. My job. Slay him. You call me, chief?
Yeah, it's the dragon again, devouring maidens. The king's daughter may be next.
Mm-hmm. You got a lead?
Yeah, nothing much to go on. Say, did you take that .45 automatic into the lab to have him check on it?
Yeah. You were right.
I was right?
Yeah. It was a gun.
Do you really think you can get away with that?
Why not?
It makes fun of the police, and the police preserve law and order, and anyone who is against law and order is against America.
Oh, come on.
However, no good American would buy such a scurrilous record.
But more than a million of them already have. Maybe we better call them back.
Oh. Well, it's anti-British, too.
I'll bite why.
It lampoons St. George, the patron saint of England.
You don't leave me much to satirize.
That's not my problem. There's got to be a censor to keep you fellows in line. There always has been.
Maybe so, but he hasn't always been as tough as you are. Just this year, the world lost a great satirist who knew the bitterness which is the lot of a man in mid-century America who refuses to take things too seriously. You remember his acid sarcasm?
California is a great place to live if you're an orange.
The biting wit of Fred Allen was finally suffocated in a society where slapstick is king and where it is all right for a man to take a pratfall as long as he falls on his own prat. But nothing was sacred to Fred Allen, from network vice presidents to Mom herself.
For 20 years, my mother kept a light burning in the window for me. When I came home, my mother gave me a royal welcome and a gas bill for $729.
Can you guess who got sore at this little interchange?
Well, Mr. Cassidy, what is that ladder you have there?
I'm going over to Sweeney's for dinner.
And you have to carry a ladder?
The dining room table is too high. You can't sit on chairs. Everybody eats on a ladder.
Why is the dining room table so high?
Sweeney is a mounted cock. He always rides into dinner on his horse.
Oh?
Sweeney never uses a napkin. He wipes his hands on the back of his horse. There's so much food on the back of Sweeney's horse, he has mice under his saddle. Goodbye to you.
Well, who do you suppose beefed about that innocuous scene? The mounted police? The American Society of Ladder Manufacturers? Mice? No, the Irish. Or at least a small, militant, vociferous, and humorless group of Irishmen. So finally, Ajax Cassidy was written out of the show. It seems to me that today only two mediums remain where the satirist may operate with the widest latitude. Books and the theater. Elsewhere, there are restrictions of one kind or another. Even in phonograph records, which sometimes end up in locked vaults instead of music store shelves. Here's part of a satire which Dawes Butler and I wrote, but never recorded, and which you are about to hear for the first and last time.
In the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, and the trail of the lonesome pine, well, away, 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 gee whiz, it's a nice day.
That's right, Arthur.
Well, you look like you had a good night's sleep, lad.
That's right, Arthur.
It's a pretty tie you're wearing.
That's right, Arthur. That's right, Arthur.
Well, I just cleared my throat, is all. See, I was over to the Douglas factory the other day. They had a 1 cent sale. You buy one DC-3 for $100,000, you get the other one for a penny. I think you folks can still get in on it if you hurry right over.
That's right, Arthur.
See, how about a tune from Frank? You want to sing Frank?
Yes, I do, and my name is Frank.
Well, it's Frank as far as I'm concerned.
Frank.
Say, guess who I had warming up in the audition pen this morning?
Who?
Morton Downey.
Call me Frank.
Okay, all those in the cast who want to see my new Honolulu movies, hold up your leg irons.
There isn't time, Arthur. The program's almost over.
Oh, what a shame. Well, I think I got time for one joke. You see this ukulele? They bought it with no strings attached. What's that? What's that noise?
It was me, Arthur. I was drinking a glass of noodle soup when you told that last joke. I wasn't able to laugh in time, so I did the next best thing. I gargled.
See, that's thinking on your feet. Only the quick thinkers stay with me. Hey, you with the freckles, you're fired. Oh, that's me. I'm looking in the mirror.
That's right, Arthur.
We'll see you Monday, folks. If you want to have some fun over the weekend, get out and build your own airstrip. It's more fun than a barrel of monkeys.
Sing it, Arthur.
In the blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, on the trail of the lonesome pine.
Ah, the censor's still with us, huh?
Oh, very much so. Oh, very funny, very funny.
I thought you'd be gone, but you liked it, huh?
Oh, indeed, I did.
Ah, no comment, no cuts, no blue pencil?
Well, no, not really. Now, of course, in all honesty, I must say, I think that last joke was a wee mite suspect.
Oh, what joke was that?
The one about the ukulele with no strings attached.
What's suspect about that?
Well, it does seem to infer that Hawaiians are not above indulging in sharp business practices, such as the sale of stringless ukuleles.
Oh, I see.
But then we must be lenient.
I hadn't noticed.
After all, our ancestors in Connecticut were alleged to have sold wooden nutmegs from time to time. So we can afford to be lenient.
Lenient, huh? Mm. Well, that's a step in the right direction. And tell me, Mr. C.
Censor is the name.
Pardon me. Do you consider hi-fi enthusiasts sacred cows?
Hi-fi enthusiast sacred... I don't even know what they are.
Well, then I can speak freely.
Radio station WHIFIFM, serving the greater Milltown area, is once more proud to bring you at this time your weekly high-fidelity forum of the air. And here is your moderator, Feedback Frugal.
Yes, thank you. Well, every week at this time, I have to ask all you people listening on anything less than a 15-inch speaker with an 8-inch tweeter to tune out, please. We don't mean to be undemocratic, but we're a select group, and we can't have just anybody listening. Thank you, so get out, please. Well, tonight our panel looks a little bit like who's who in hi-fi. To my right, Mr. H.H. Horn, president of the Summit Ridge Louder and Louder Club. Mr. Horn? Mr. Horn?
And to my right, Mr. Dacron Grillcloth, editor of Assemble It Yourself magazine.
Thank you, and good evening. And on my right, a very charming teenager, Miss Rhoda May Flug of the West Branch Falls branch of the Johann Sebastian Bach Fan Club. I believe that's the inscription on your windbreaker, Miss Flug.
I hope your ears are better than your eyes. It says, "Don't knock Bach." That's the slogan of our club.
Oh, that's the slogan.
We have jerseys, too, that say, "Every toccata is worth a fugue."
Fine. Thank you, Miss Flug, for the plug. Well, that's our panel. Now, first, we'll play just a teeny bit of a brand-new LP recording and see who'll be the first to identify it. Here we go.
I think you'll find it works better if you remove the record jacket first.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It's my mistake. Here we go. Dirty jacket. Well, there we are. Now try and identify this. Well, that's about enough of that, I guess. Whoa! Sorry. Well, my arm slipped. I'm sorry. Now, do you know who that was? H.H. Horn had his hand up.
Well, that was played over a Pimlington amplifier model 220.
Right so far.
With a Feely preamp and Magnus tone arm.
What do you mean a Feely preamp? That had over 1.6% hum. You can't get that kind of distortion out of a Feely.
My dear Miss Flug, I can hear up to 20,000 cycles.
All right. All right. I'm afraid Miss Flug has got you there, H.H. It was a Murdoch Jr. with over 2% hum. Now, what about the turntable, Mr. Grillcloth?
Yes, well, it has quite a bit of rumble in it. I think it was the new Murdoch just on the market.
Right you are. Do you think it'll sell 200,000?
No. They have quite a few bugs in them yet.
I got a Murdoch. It doesn't have any bugs.
What? Well, they've got a rumble like a cement mixer.
Well, sure they do if you don't use a foam rubber spindle adapter.
All right. Did anybody recognize the music?
Tell you the truth, I wasn't listening to the music.
Me either.
Well, no matter. Now we come to our contest. If you can guess the sound, you win a life-size inflatable latex rubber Liberace. He comes with his arms extended, ready to be blown up and set down at your own piano.
Yeah,
now what familiar sound is this? Listen. Well, I don't see any hands. That was Benny Goodman in a skin diver suit, 20 feet underwater, playing Danny Boy in a kelp bed.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think it was that.
H.H., you should have had that. Well, now one more just quickly here.
Recognize that sound?
I think that was a... No, I give up.
Yeah, what was that?
That was King Farouk in his skin diver suit, 20 feet underwater, applauding Benny Goodman.
Oh, well, if you'd played that on something beside a lousy Murdoch turntable without all that rumble,
What do you mean, lousy Murdoch? I'd like to hear your turntable.
All right, Miss Flug, you'll have an opportunity right now. Mr. Grillcloth has assembled his home hi-fi kit here in the studio, and we're all going to get a little listen, right, Doctor?
Yes. As advertised in our magazine, assemble it yourself. Now, of course, in order to prepare for our kit, you have to rip out all the walls in the interior of your house.
I see.
Next, our acoustical walls go up in sections.
Prefabricated.
More or less. One wall is solid tennis balls. The other asbestos. The third, wet bathing suits. And the fourth, a sort of a foam rubber bas relief mural of the Pickens sisters in repose.
Some acoustics, Roger. What about equipment?
Well, I use 5 21-inch speakers in the ceiling, as you can see here. I have it all set up there. Plus a 10-foot horn enclosure in each corner. I have a Stylemaster preamp and a Fomroy turntable.
Oh, the waste one he could have picked.
Listen, madam, people who own Murdoch turntables should not...
All right, now. How much does all that equipment cost? I know our listeners will be anxious.
Yes, well, I'll tell you.
Find out the...
Yes, please, I'll tell you. $5,499.50 takes it home. Of course, the cost of building the railroad spur right to your house, which is essential, is not included
in
that.
Not included in the price. Well, could we hear a little music through your system? I see you have it all set up.
No. No, I'm afraid it wasn't designed for this studio.
Oh, that's a shame.
No, the room won't stand the stress.
Oh, I think it would, but I'm sure our listeners would have enjoyed hearing it.
I would have enjoyed hearing
it. No, not me. This way I don't have to hear that more than 5% turntable rumble in that lousy farm roar.
Just a minute, Miss Smart Alec.
Yeah, you just break the
panel. Here, Miss Blog, put your windbreaker back on, please.
All right, you want to hear a little hi-fi, eh? Well, listen to this.
That concludes our weekly high-fidelity Forum of the Air. Now back to the frothy beat of Claude Hopper and his boys.
There is still hope for laughter in America, for there are still satirists in America. Where a hardy species is difficult to extinguish is liberty itself. Our names are familiar and our lust for laughter cannot be discouraged. You may think of us as cartoonists, writers, comics, perhaps, but we are all fundamentally satirists, from Chaucer to James Thurber, from Molière to S.J. Perelman, from George Bernard Shaw to Dorothy Parker, Al Capp, Voltaire, Sid Caesar, Groucho Marx, Bob and Ray, Walt Kelly's Pogo, and Jonathan Swift's Lilliput. The list would outrun the time we have left, but all of us all have this in common. In seeking to blow away mankind's absurdities on a gust of ridicule, we hope to make mankind's burden a little easier to bear. Before you reach for that blue pencil, stop and think. Can you imagine life without a laugh?
You have just heard the CBS Radio Workshop production of Colloquy 3, an analysis of satire, starring the Capitol recording artist Dan Freeberg, and produced and directed in Hollywood by William N. Robeson. Colloquy 3 was written by Mr. Freeberg and Mr. Robeson, with music by Lynn Murray. Included in the cast were June Foray, Dawes Butler, Sam Pierce, Larry Thor, Parley Bear, Alan Reed, and Bill Thompson. Next week from New York, the workshop will present the radio premiere of The Hither and Thither of Danny Dither, a modern morality play in which a very young angel upsets a celestial efficiency expert's efforts to streamline heaven. Stay tuned for 5 minutes of CBS News, to be followed over most of these same stations by My Son Jeep. And don't forget, CBS, caution before speed. This is the CBS Radio Network.
You're listening to the Old Time Radio Hour, broadcast each week over the World Wide Web with your host, Justine Ward. Find us on iTunes, Podbean, or RSS. We covered the history of the CBS network in the past few weeks, and this week we begin the history of NBC. We are presenting part one this week without commercials. This series is very well done, with some iconic sound bites from history. Part one is narrated by Ben Grauer and takes us all the way back to radio's very beginning in 1912. It includes historical recording of Lindbergh's flight. I know you will enjoy this informative and entertaining look back at history of radio from its very beginning. Enjoy NBC, The First Fabulous 50, Part 1, first broadcast October 10th, 1976, on NBC.
NBC Radio Network celebrates its first Fabulous 50.
Hi, ho, everybody.
Good evening, Mr. First Matthews.
Good evening, Mr. and Mr. North American. All the ships at sea, let's go to press.
The only thing we have to fear.
Ladies and gentlemen, easy aces.
Mr. Allen!
We are resolved to destroy Hitler.
You were expecting maybe Emperor Shapiro Hito.
Everybody awake! Let the word go forth.
Ignition. Liftoff.
I have a dream.
Hello, Linda.
I'm mortified.
Flow like a butterfly.
Sting like a bee.
Let me make one point clear.
Robert De Yes!
NBC Radio, America's first network, presents highlights from its first 50 years. 5 one-hour shows with hosts Ben Grauer, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Arlene Francis, and John Chancellor. And special material by David Brinkley. Brought to you by the premium wines of Ernest and Julio Gallo and by the makers of other fine quality products. Your host this hour, Ben Grauer.
It all really began back in 1912, the date April 14th. SS Titanic ran into iceberg, sinking fast. The dots and dashes that spelled out this news were heard by a young wireless operator at a station on top of Wanamaker's department store in New York. For the next 72 hours, without a break, he became the only link with the developing story. As President Taft ordered all other stations to shut down in order to keep this one clear line of communication open. Through this event, David Sarnoff, that was the operator's name, proved to the world the value of radio. In the years that followed, it progressed from dots and dashes to words and music. Then, on the evening of November 15th, 1926, 1,000 elegantly attired guests gathered in the grand ballroom of the old Waldorf Astoria in New York, down on 34th Street, for the first broadcast of the NBC radio network. They and several million of us at home, listening to one of the 26 stations that made up the network, heard these opening words from NBC's first president, Merlin Aylesworth.
Beginning tonight, you will receive a new thrill in radio. In the future, those engaged in production will, through the power of radio broadcasting, with modern radio equipment, offer their talent, whether in song, drama, comedy, or orchestral music.
And NBC Radio was on its way. Opera stars sang, orchestras played, comedians made us laugh. One of the very first was Will Rogers, who just loved to poke fun at everybody's favorite target.
With Congress, every time they make a joke, it's a law. You know, every time they make a law, it's a joke.
Sounds as timely today as it did 50 years ago, doesn't it? And when the opening festivities were over and the network moved on to regular daily broadcasting, our first great comedy stars, Amos and Andy, also found politics a source of fun.
You don't know politics like I do.
Tell me this, though. Why can't they have a Democrat and a Republican president at the same time?
The trouble with that is the Republican would get everything messed up for the Democrat and vice versa.
And what?
Vice versa.
He ain't running, is he?
You know, Amos and Andy were so popular that when 7 o'clock rolled around and they were on the air, just about everything stopped. Phone calls, conversation, even meals. Well, comedy and music were what listeners wanted. So NBC went out and got the best. In 1928, Broadway's most exciting star, Al Jolson, joined us.
What do you think has come over me? I can't stand it. I feel a song coming on. Give out. I feel a song coming on. And I'm warning you, it's a victorious, happy and glorious new reign.
And from the Ziegfeld Follies, where he was billed as the perfect fool, Ed Wynn came to NBC, eventually winding up as Texaco's fire chief.
The title of tonight's opera is Rosalie. Rosalie is so fat that when she goes to bed, she reminds you of an ocean liner. It takes a couple of tugs to get her out of a slip. I got some that are worse than that.
Also, from Broadway and the movies, the beloved little banjo eyes, Eddie Cantor, whose wife Ida didn't mind when he sang about other girls.
If you knew Susie like I know Susie, oh, 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 what a girl. There's none so classy as this fair lassie. Oh, 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 my goodness, what a chassis. We went.
Then there was a chap who added the word crooner to our vocabulary, Rudy Valley, who on his own program played straight man to comedian Jack Pearl, who played the role of Baron Munchausen, teller of tall tales.
Just a second. Do you want me to believe that you swam all the way from New York to South America?
Well, I would prefer it.
Well, I'm not going to believe a thing like that.
Rudy, if you ain't going to believe a thing like that, you're going to have a lot of trouble with the stuff that comes later. You see?
And then there was the man who was not just loved by his audiences, but by his fellow comedians as well. The peerless Jack Benny.
For your information, Don, when I started radio, I was 22.
What are you talking about? I knew you then and you had gray hair.
Don, I was born with gray hair. I was worried about the doctor bill. Now, I'm glad I didn't pay him slapping me when my back was turned. And, Don, here's an amazing coincidence. After all these years, who do you think is sitting in the audience this very moment?
The doctor.
No, his lawyer. The case comes up in court when...
What a lineup of great talent NBC had right from the start. And that went for newsmen as well. John Chancellor will tell us about that shortly.
The First Fabulous 50 will continue right after this. Now back to the First Fabulous 50 with Ben Grauer.
You know, from the earliest days, NBC Radio News brought our listeners something newspapers could never provide: immediacy, the story as it happened, and in addition, the actual voices of those involved. I'm happy to have John Chancellor with us to illustrate this. John?
Thank you, Ben. The first great example of the concept Ben has just discussed begins on the 20th of May, 1927. The Roaring Twenties, the Jazz Age. 23 Skidoo and OU Kid. Clara Bow was appearing in Rough House Rosie, Lon Chaney and Mr. Wu. The country was thriving, full of hustle and bustle. But at Yankee Stadium that evening, before the heavyweight championship fight between Jack Sharkey and Jim Maloney, 40,000 people stood in silent prayer to wish Godspeed to a young man who, that morning, had started on a flight to immortality. The world waited while monitors reported sightings. Halifax, Nova Scotia. Then Belfast, Ireland. Cherbourg, France, and finally, 33 and a half hours later on NBC Radio.
This is Lowell Thomas in New York. He made it. Charles A. Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy as they call him, landed at Le Bourget Airport, Paris at 5:24 this afternoon, thus becoming the first person to fly New York to Paris nonstop.
Charles Lindbergh, the lone eagle, became the reigning hero of the world. Wild receptions in Paris, London, and when he returned to this country on the U.S. cruiser Memphis, he was greeted by cheering throngs in Washington, D.C. NBC Radio was there in the person of Graham McNamee.
And now the National Broadcasting Company and Associated Radio Station ask you to just listen to the band for a few moments, because particularly this is the first time band music or music has been transmitted from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast.
This was followed by President Coolidge's speech at the Washington Monument.
I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross as a symbol of appreciation for what he is and what he has done upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
When Coolidge described Lindbergh, it sounded as though his speechwriter had dipped into a thesaurus.
Intelligent, industrious, energetic, dependable, purposeful, alert, quick of reaction, serious, deliberate.
One attribute the president neglected to include was Lindbergh's sense of humor, which Lindy revealed during a speech at a press club dinner later that day.
When I landed at Le Bourget, I landed with the expectancy and the hope of being able to see Europe. And I wasn't in any hurry to get back. And I was informed that while it wasn't an order to come back home, that there'd be a battleship waiting for me next week.
Lucky Lindy? Lucky indeed, although his ability and courage played a decisive role in his success. And when the young hero went on to marry the talented, charming heiress, Anne Morrow, it seemed that all the ingredients for a storybook happy ending had been assembled except one. The birth of their first child, a boy, Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr., provided that final ingredient.
Lucky Lindy!
But the "They Lived Happily Ever After" ending was not to be. On April the 3rd, 1936, there was this bulletin on NBC Radio.
The National Broadcasting Company presents a special bulletin. Trenton, New Jersey. Bruno Richard Hauptmann was electrocuted at 8:47 tonight for the murder of the Lindbergh baby.
The death of the German-born carpenter had followed one of the most widely publicized murder trials in history. And the Lindberghs withdrew into almost total isolation from the public, except for a brief reemergence by Colonel Lindbergh several years later, urging us not to get involved in World War II. This, coupled with his earlier praise of the German Air Force, caused some people to label Lindbergh a Nazi sympathizer, a stigma which marred to the end the life of the first American hero that the public got to know on the radio.
Thank you, John. I'd like to add a brief personal note, if I may, about that kidnapping. As NBC's reporter at the Trenton State Police headquarters, waiting for word, I broadcast the Lindbergh baby's formula in the desperate hope that the kidnappers would hear it and take care of the baby. It was one of the most moving moments of all my years at the network.
More from NBC's first 50 years after this. NBC's first Fabulous 50 continues. Once again, Ben Grauer.
Earlier we heard some of the great performers who were established stars before they came to NBC. But we also developed our own radio personalities. The Happiness Boys, for instance, Billy Jones and Ernie Hare.
She is gone, let her go. You're not fast, but not too slow. She'll never find a fella like me. Just feel great, you just laughed. I tore up her photograph. She'll never find a fella like me.
No, it's not Renfrew of the Mounted. This was the opening theme of the Clico Club Eskimos. Harry Reese, leading his musicians, clad in fur parkas. They were really wearing fur parkas. I wore a tuxedo. See, I was the announcer. In the comedy department, there were easy aces.
That money is in a bank to stay, and he's
not... Oh, all right. The minute you mention that money, you fly off the coop.
I'll fly off the coop when you start talking about our nest egg that we laid away for later on. There's nothing you need that money for now.
Oh, well, we could travel and meet new people. I get tired of the same couples all the time. You know how they say, familiarity breeds attempt.
Isn't that awful? Would you mind if we don't discuss this anymore? I'd like to finish my paper here.
And wherever you live, coast to coast, you didn't have to pay a personal visit to Manhattan to enjoy its music. NBC provided instant travel.
Jump on the Manhattan merry-go-round. We're touring, alluring the New York town. Broadway, a lot of the musical show. Be our guest if you rest at your radio.
We had music from the big city, and we had comedy about small-town families. One of the most lovable and most witty was Vic Insane. Here, Vic is playing Rummy with his teenage son, Rush.
Your sweet face is painted with a happy leer. I apprehend you think you've won the game.
I have won the game. Look here.
Hey, hey.
You fellas done with your Rummy?
Dry Rot just blundered into an accidental victory.
It's always accidental when I win.
Better hop into that algebra study and hadn't you, son?
Algebra sure is a rotten topic. Fails to hold an individual's interest.
You'll feel an individual's interest where you don't want it if that report card ain't up to snuff this time.
Oh.
Rush, get your feet down from there.
I enjoy the sensation of twisting my spine out of shape.
Get them down, I said.
Twist his spine out of shape. Kids in the 30s weren't very different from kids today, were they? But when it came to music, we had someone with us at NBC then who was unique. As a singer of light classical music, she was supreme. Jessica Dragonette, queen of radio. I can see her now, standing center stage in the old Cathedral Studio at 711 Fifth Avenue. A slight figure, golden-haired, her firm little chin tilted high, and the notes pouring out. Cathedral Studio, we drop in at 79 Wistful Vista, where Fibber McGee and Molly are in the kitchen.
McGee never helps me wash the dirty dishes, McGee.
Come in. You kids want to buy any Easter eggs?
No, thank you, Mr. Oldtimer. I don't believe we want any.
Oh, come on, kids. Later, kid. Sorry, I didn't want any Easter eggs.
Hey, that's the wrong door open.
No, that's the closet door.
Oh, no. Ain't you kids ever going to straighten out that gosh darn museum?
Well, we're glad they never got it straightened out because it never failed to give us a laugh. Still does. Well, we're approaching station break time in our first Fabulous 50 celebration. But rather than my saying, this is Ben Grauer, etc., etc., listen to what the late H.B. Kaltenborn, first dean of NBC Newsmen, once said about this traditional pause.
The announcer would suck in his breath and rattle off, "This is station WEAF, WJR, WTAG, WTIC, WLIT, WCSH, naming every station on the hookup." That was in 1926. A few months, and several breathless announcers later, we bought the electrical chimes. They cost only $48.50 at the time, but think of all the trouble they save as we now take a short pause for station identification.
NBC continues celebrating its first Fabulous 50. Here's your host, Ben Grauer.
Like any healthy youngster, the NBC radio network was full of curiosity. We were willing to try just about anything. We even had Ben Burney, the old maestro, trying to do on-the-scene coverage of a scientific balloon flight. Ben was better at band leading. But when it came to sports, NBC was there, fustest with the mostest. Graham McNamee, with the first coast-to-coast Rose Bowl in 1927. And then, in 1929, at the Kentucky Derby, Clem McCarthy calling the run for the Roses down the homestretch.
Look out! On the outside, here comes the California coach, Nishifer. He's coming at Clay Van Dusen. The jockey, Tony Lockety, shakes his whip, and the son of mighty man-o'-war comes away. Clay Van Dusen by three lengths.
In 1934, heavyweight boxing champion Primo Carnera was losing to challenger Max Baer, and Graham McNamee was there.
Carnera has fallen. Carnera has fallen again, but he is up instantly. The man won't stay down. Talk about nerve. He'll fight till he's dead, that man. He'll fight till nothing can stop him. Carnera is almost through, though.
Thanks to Graham's blow-by-blow description, folks listening to NBC at home had a much better idea of what was going on in the ring than most of the paying customers out there in the far reaches of Yankee Stadium. And there was a bonus for radio listeners. Graham brought a perspiring pugilist into their homes that night to deliver what eventually became the traditional greeting to a prize fighter's best friend, his mother.
And now I'll have Max Baer over here in a minute, who has just won the heavyweight championship of the world.
Hi, Graham.
Hello, kiddo.
Hi, mother. I want to say hello to you. I'm very happy.
Joe Humphreys is now raising Max Baer's hand, a token of winning.
Hello, Mom.
Hello, Mom. From Max Baer, the victor's valedictory. Then there was the contest. I guess you couldn't call it a sporting event. The contest involving three NBC regulars, Graham McNamee, Milton Cross, and someone who shall or certainly should be nameless, a speed-talking contest. Graham and Milton had done their bit, and then the final contestant read from Alice in Wonderland.
The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright, and this was odd because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily because she thought the sun had gotten a visit to be there after the day was done. It's very rude of him. She had to come and spoil the fun. The sea was wet as wet could be. The sands were dry as dry. You couldn't see a cloud because no cloud was in the sky, and the birds were flying overhead. There were no birds to fly. The wall wasn't the common to walk closer. They weren't like anything to see. She spotted these and said, this were only cleared away. They said it would be grand. The time has come. The wall was said to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and so the sea is boiling hot and where the pigs have wings. But wait a bit, the oyster cried, before we have a chat, and some of us are out of bed and all of us are fat. No hurry, said the commoner. They thanked them much for that. A loaf of bread, the wall was said, is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar besides a very good meal.
Very, very, very good. We had to rule Graham McNamee out because he skipped a whole page.
Yeah.
Milton Cross did 364, and Ben Grouse up around 437. So, ladies and gentlemen, the winner and champion of these premises, Ben Grouse.
Say a few words to the folks back home, Ben.
Hello, Mom.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, it's plain the imprint of Max Baer was still in the tip of my tongue when that event took place. Well, we also covered events that had a heartwarming side to them. The annual return of the Swallows to Capistrano was one of them. At the Mission of San Juan in California was reporter Buddy Twiss.
It seems only fitting that the first greeting to the Swallow should come from the little children to whom they bring the most joy and happiness. A traditional song that is sung each year on the day of the arrival of the Swallows. Good morning, Mr. Swallow.
Good morning, Mr. Swallow. Come from far away. We are glad to see
you. Although it wasn't done for that reason, the broadcast did help save the Mission, which was on the verge of closing for lack of funds, as listeners sent in contributions, voluntary contributions. In 1936, NBC News took to the air in more ways than one. We sent reporter Jack Fraser in a plane to cover the arrival of the Queen Mary on its maiden voyage.
Coming up now on the starboard side of the ship, as they wave as we pass by to the starboard. We dip our wings as we pass by now. We're just passing the front funnel.
But radio didn't just confine itself to fun and games. When the great floods of the middle 30s swept across the Ohio and Mississippi River valleys, our NBC affiliates there didn't just report the disaster, but they took an active part in the rescue work. among them WLW in Cincinnati, WAVE in Louisville, and in Memphis, Tennessee, station WMC did its share.
To the residents of Ashport, Tennessee and vicinity, Potter Dredge Boat is now at Ashport and will take refugees picked up at Gold Dust and inhabitants of Ashport to Ashport Bluff tomorrow. Anyone wanting to get out, come to Jap Henderson's store at Ashport tonight or as early as possible. We repeat a message that we gave...
From that
earlier,
day to this, through flood, tornado, hurricane, earthquake, whenever help has been needed, radio has been there.
More of NBC's First Fabulous 50 after this. Now back to the First Fabulous 50 and host Ben Grauer.
From our earliest days, NBC has pioneered just about all the varied features broadcast on radio and television. Back in 1929, for example.
You! Is anybody?
That's the way the Goldbergs began. And Molly and Jake and their children, Rosalie and Sandy, made the daily dramatic serial an instant success thanks to the warm, humorous nature of the show, very close to reality. Other daytime dramas which followed drifted away from this reality, became known as soap operas because of their melodramatic storylines and the nature of their sponsors' products. Among them were Road to Life, Porsche Faces Life, and these.
The story of young Dr. Malone, dedicated to those men and women whose selfless service has inspired it, our doctors.
And now, Stella Dallas, a continuation on the air of the true-to-life story of mother love and sacrifice, in which Stella Dallas saw her beloved daughter Laurel marry into wealth and society, and realizing the difference in their social worlds, went out of Laurel's life. One Man's Family is dedicated to the mothers and fathers of the younger generation and to their bewildering offspring. Tonight, we present Chapter 7, Book 43, entitled, The Man Who Lay With His Face in the Leaves.
They weren't kidding. That was really the title of the episode. So it's easy to see why soap operas became a natural subject for satire. And no one ever did a better job of it than the great comedy team who were with us at NBC for years, Bob and Ray.
And now, Tanglefoot, the greatest name in flypaper, brings you another episode of One Fella's Family. Today's episode, entitled Paint Up, Clean Up, is taken from Book 22, Chapter XXIV, pages 15, 16, 17, and two sentences from the middle of page 18. It's shortly after 9 in the morning as we look in on the Butcher family. We find Father Butcher.
Fairly, have you seen my purple paint?
And Mother Butcher standing just inside the door, and she answers,
What?
And then Father Butcher.
I said, Fairly, have you seen
Will
my
purple...
Will
you be quiet, announce, and let us do it now, please?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I just trying to be helpful.
What were you saying, fool announcer? Then he said, then she says, and then he says.
It's perfectly obvious.
We know what we're saying, thank you. We were here for more rehearsals than you were.
I do add more words
to
your...
I didn't have to be here for all rehearsals, you know.
Well, you should see the end of the sentence.
I just do the commercials and introduce the show. And I don't think that it's in the contract that I have to take any guff from either one of you two.
Well,
let us do the program, and then we'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
What were you saying now, Father?
Yes, I've lost my place here now.
Pool announcer.
I think you said something first.
Well, you were looking for paint.
Fairly, have you seen my purple paint?
What do you want with purple paint?
Huh?
He wants to paint the garage with it.
He knows what I want to do, and it's
in
her next
line. Will you be quiet?
Well,
now then.
I'm not in the mood, Fairly.
For what?
To do this confounded script.
Well, you're on the air. You can't just say you're not in the mood.
You better count it, folks. Time's run out.
Oh, am I going to burn?
Will Father Butcher ever feel like finishing the episode? Will Fanny finally bop the announcer? Wish we could say, tune in tomorrow and find out, but it's all part of the past now. However, do stay tuned for David Brinkley.
More of NBC Radio's anniversary celebration shortly. We're here. NBC's first Fabulous 50. And once again, Ben Grauer.
As I said a little while ago, daytime dramatic shows began in 1929 on NBC. That was also the year when the first great national crisis of the radio era began. We've asked David Brinkley to guide us through it. David?
Ben, 1929 started quietly enough for most citizens, but on Valentine's Day, in a garage on North Clark Street, Chicago, a somewhat noisy surprise party was held. Seven gangsters were massacred by fellow professionals costumed in police uniforms. As usual, the real police suspected Al Capone, but also, as usual, they were unable to prove a case against him. Following this, no doubt, historic event, the year moved along, the economy was flying high, Admiral Richard Byrd flew high, too, over the South Pole, and on October 24th, a new variety program became airborne on NBC Radio.
My time is your time. Your time.
Rudy Valley, self-styled vagabond lover, settled down as host for the show on which he would introduce many of the great comedians of the era. The next day, and no cause and effect relationship has ever been established, the next day, the great stock market crash began. Before it was over, the value of securities had dropped $30 billion. Some stockbrokers, ruined by the crash, followed the descent of their fortunes by leaping from the upper floors of tall buildings, furnishing material for a somewhat macabre joke by the usually lovable Eddie Cantor.
Nowadays, when a man walks into a hotel and requests a room on the 19th floor, the clerk asks him, for sleeping or jumping?
Keep your sunny side up, up. Hide the side that gets blue.
Despite this musical encouragement, as devastation spread from the stock market through the entire economy and unemployment rose to unprecedented levels, 12 million out of work at a time when our population was half what it is today, despair and anger became the reigning emotions of the day. Drastic solutions were called for. Herbert Hoover, the man who had become president in 1928 with his chicken in every pot, two cars in every garage slogan, defined the major issue as he sought re-election in 1932.
This campaign is more than a contest between two men. It is more than a contest between two parties. It is a contest between two philosophies of government.
Mr. Hoover's philosophy lost, and on March 4th, 1933, the new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, began an explanation of his philosophy with a phrase that became as famous as some of Shakespeare's.
First of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
A day later, Roosevelt again made use of network radio for the first of his fireside chats.
I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days, why it was done, and what the next steps are going to be. The bank holiday, while resulting in many cases in great inconvenience, is a...
The bank holiday was the first of many dramatic moves Roosevelt made. There was also the Agricultural Adjustment Act, then the Civilian Conservation Corps, and other programs. All became better known by their initials, but not necessarily better loved by FDR's enemies, not the least vocal of whom was Louisiana's flamboyant Senator Huey Long, who referred to himself as the Kingfish, after the character in Amos and Andy, who was head of the Mystic Knights of the Sea.
Now it is with the PWAs, the GWAs, the NRAs, the AAAs, JUGs, and the GINs. There is starvation, there is homelessness, There's misery on every hand and corner. But mind you, in the meantime, Mr. Roosevelt has had his way. There's one man that can't blame anything on anybody but himself, and that's Mr. Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Despite Senator Long's skillful attack, President, as he put it, Franklin Delano Roosevelt persisted. And by the 1936 convention, a song which had had the misfortune of being written in 1929, the year of the crash, now seemed to have a measure of validity. Happy days are here again. But were they?
We have the strength. Das deutsche Haupt von wieder mit Stolz erhoben tragen zu dürfen. Wir alle aber haben die Pflicht, es nie wieder unter einen fremden Willen zu bringen. Dies sei unser Gelöbnis, so wahr uns Gott helfe.
Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!
In Germany, growing out of the Depression there and feeding on a diet of nationalism and racism, the Nazi menace had emerged. But we were too busy enjoying our re-emerging prosperity to pay it much attention. For us, Ben, happy days, if not here again, seemed not too far off.
True, David, and arrive they did, if only briefly, before World War II began.
More from NBC Radio's first 50 years right after this. Here's Ben Grauer again with more of NBC's first Fabulous 50.
As we weathered those Depression years, we saw new programs added almost every month to the NBC roster. Broadcasts from the Metropolitan Opera, religious programs, a new type of show called panel shows. And we heard new superstars in the making. Let's go back to the original Amateur Hour with Major Bowes.
Good evening, friends. Once again, the wheel of chance, or fate, as you please, is about to revolve. And as the barker standing at the wheel of fortune says, around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows. Nor does anybody know what will
happen. That night, the wheel stopped in front of a brash, skinny kid from Hoboken. Name is Sinatra.
Who speaks for the group?
I will. I'm Frank, Major. We're looking for jobs. How about it? Everyone that's ever heard us liked us. We think we're pretty good. And we play real swing music, too.
Real modern swing music. Ultra-modern music. What's your tune?
The Curse of an Aching Heart.
Curse of an Aching Heart.
You made me what I am today. I hope you're satisfied. You drag me down and down until the soul within me dies.
Even way back then, he did it his way. And he finally got his own show on NBC. And on October 26, 1935, Wallace Beery, gruff, tough, and lovable movie star, was host to a 12-year-old girl on another NBC variety show.
Now, what do you want to do when you grow up to be a great big girl, huh?
I want to be a singer, Mr. Beery. And I'd like to act, too.
Well, you'll do it. Don't worry. I'll go right to it, and if you need me, I'll be standing right there. You
hear? Broadway, street of a million lights. Broadway, street of a million sights. Broadway, street of a million nights. Nights of pain and sorrows. Nights that promise gay tomorrows. But up or down or sad or gay, there's something in this whole Broadway that makes you tingle in and out, that makes you get right up and shout. Everybody dance. Broadway rhythm, it's got me. Everybody dance. Out on the gay white way in each merry cafe, orchestras play, taking your breath away with a Broadway rhythm. It's got me. Everybody sing. What it is to do today. Yeah. What does do? What does do? What he do? What he do? Going to town, going to town. Yeah, yeah. Everybody dance.
Judy Garland, 12 years old, showing then all the skill that made her one of the greatest entertainers of our age. Well, that's a tough act to follow, but there are a couple of fellas who can manage it, both of them hosting their own shows for many years here on NBC.
First, I'd like to hear you sing.
Okay. When the blue of the night meets the gold of the day, someone waits for me. Well, what do you think, Mr. Holt?
Let me see your feet.
My feet?
Fire. With that voice, you'll make a wonderful grape crusher.
The prospective grape crusher was Bing Crosby, of course. And the cheerfully caustic comments came from Bob Hope. Bob will be your host for the second hour of our anniversary celebration next week. More comedy then, more music, and the real-life drama of a world at war, as well as other memorable sounds from our second decade. Well, this is where I get off. Just reviewing these fabulous years with you has really been a pleasure. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I. This is Ben Grauer.
You have been listening to the First Fabulous 50, produced by the NBC Radio Network and NBC News.
Thank you so much for listening to the Old Time Radio Hour. I know you will enjoy the next two parts of the history of NBC during the Golden Age of Radio if you are able to join us next week, when we broadcast parts 2 and 3 of this fine series. I hope you can join us next week. Until then, this is your host, Justine Ward, saying so long for a while.